textbook. It's not a science textbook, right? And that's true, it's not. Science textbooks change every few years when we learn that we got some things wrong and we need to adjust it. The Bible doesn't need to be adjusted. God got it right the first time. That being said, the Bible does, on occasion, touch on matters of science. In the context of giving history, the Bible is primarily a history book. It does have other types of literature. It does have poetic sections and so on, but it's primarily a history book. But it's a history book that's been written by inspiration from God. It's God-breathed. What the Bible says is what God says. And so when the Bible touches on a matter of science, when the Bible says something that has significance to astronomy, the Bible is right and it's to be trusted. And if you don't trust it, it's to your own disadvantage, not to God's. So let's jump right in and we'll see how the glory of the Lord's revealed in creation. That's something that the Bible teaches in Psalm 19:1. One of those poetic sections, it says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. And that is, it's beautiful poetry, but it's telling us that the heavens say something about God. When we look at the heavens, we see the glory of God revealed there. And I think there are at least a couple of ways in which the universe declares God's glory. Probably many more than just two, but I'm going to mention two. The size of the universe and the beauty of the universe are consistent with the mind of God, God having created the universe for his glory, for our enjoyment as well, but for his glory ultimately. And you don't have to be an astrophysicist to appreciate the beauty of the universe. You go outside on a clear night, you do have to get away from the city, there's the light pollution there, but you look up and you see all those beautiful stars. It really is lovely. It's a beautiful universe. But we can appreciate it all the more today, when we have powerful instruments that can peer into the heavens and magnify what we see and gather more light and so on, and we find that it's even more beautiful than we could have imagined. And that is the nature of God. Just as you examine God more closely, the more you see his beauty. It's not that he's becoming greater, it's just we appreciate it more. And what about the size of the universe? That's hard to convey, because the universe is unimaginably large. And so the best we can do is compare things to other things, and that will give you kind of a feel for just how amazingly big the universe is, and that gives us a glimpse into God's power. And God's power is awesome. So let's start with the moon. This is a mosaic image of the moon where they've taken lots of high-resolution images and stitched them together. And we actually have a spacecraft orbiting the moon taking high-resolution images of the surface, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So we have mapped the moon in unbelievable detail. We know it very, very well. And the moon is fun to look at in a small telescope, especially when you see the craters that well. Illuminated right down the middle, and you can see the craters very clearly. When it's full like this, you can't really see the craters that well. But sometimes when people are looking at the moon through a telescope for the first time, wow, it's pretty amazing. And then sometimes they'll ask me, can you see the flag that the astronauts planted? Well, no, it's this is big, folks. The moon is about the same size as the United States. If you put the United States up at the same distance as the moon, it would cover the same area. That's how big it is. So you're not going to see anything that small through a small telescope. But the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, because it's taking such high-resolution images of the surface, it actually can see where the Apollo sites landed. And I want to show you one of these. This is zooming in here on Mare Tranquillitatis. This is where the Apollo 11, the first moon landing, took place. And we zoom in on it, and you see, sure enough, the lower portion of the lunar module. Remember when they landed on the moon and that spider-like looking structure, that's the LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module. And when they launched only the top portion to save fuel. The bottom portion is still there. And so you can still see it there on the surface of the moon, along with that dark streak. You see that dark streak to the right of the lunar module, slightly below it, that goes over to that crater and back. That's the footprints of the astronauts as they walked over to that crater and back. So 40-year-old footprints. The moon has no weather. It has a little layer of dust on its surface, no weather, no maid service. And so those footprints are going to be there for a very long time. Really interesting. So yes, we really did land on the moon. There it is. And there are other ways to demonstrate that as well. We left some reflectors there too, and you can reflect beams off the surface and time it. It's pretty amazing. So the scale of the cosmos is as amazing as its beauty. So let's take a look at some of the beautiful things that the Lord made. Again, we'll go back to the moon. Here it is in its first quarter phase, where it's illuminated right down the middle. And here it is compared to the Earth. You can see that, hey, we've got a pretty big planet there. Pretty awesome. And I mean, the Earth is big. If you've ever driven through Kansas, you know just how big the Earth is. You're like, wow. That's just a small region of it. So you think, wow, we got a pretty big planet there. And of course, I feel very privileged, very blessed that we live in an age where we've seen our planet, or at least we have photos of our planet from above. That's just it's a beautiful gem, and it's something that our ancestors could only have imagined. So there's the Earth from above. And you might think, well, we got a pretty big planet. And it is pretty big until you start realizing there are other planets out there that are quite a lot bigger, like a Saturn, for example. There's Saturn compared to the Earth and the Moon. Saturn's about 9 Earths across. That's just the planet. The rings extend out further from that. The rings are trillions of tiny little moonlets that orbit around Saturn's equator. They may look solid, but they're not. They're little pieces of rock and ice that are orbiting in that plane. You say, well, at least we got some pretty big planets in our solar system. Saturn size compared to the initial, but it's small compared to the sun. There's the sun at its true size compared to the Earth. See, the Earth's just a blip now, isn't it? The sun is 100 Earths across. That's just the diameter. The sun is basically a stable nuclear bomb. It's fusing hydrogen into helium in the core. That's a very efficient power source, and it's doing it at kind of a slow rate, really. And so it's able to, that energy is able to trickle to the surface and leave the sun, and it warms the Earth. And of course, the Earth's at the right distance from the sun to receive the proper amount of heat and light, and that is a design feature. God designed it just that way. The sun is an amazing example of God's power, not only because of its size, 100 Earths across, that's impressive enough. The energy that it releases, well, the sun releases more energy in 1 second than a billion major cities on Earth could use in an entire year. And if you think, well, that's wasteful, you need to remember God has unlimited power. Not a problem for God to do that. And the sun is just one star. Yes, the sun is a star. It's the same type of thing as those little pinpricks of light you see in the night sky. It's just much closer. The sun is practically our next door neighbor. It's a mere 93 million miles away. Those other stars are much further away. The sun is a main sequence star. Main sequence means it's a type of star that obeys a rule that if you know the mass of the star, it will determine all of its other properties. It will determine its core temperature. It will determine its surface brightness, its color, its temperature. And the sun obeys that rule. Most stars do. And then there are a few that are bigger than they should be. They're not main sequence. So the sun's a main sequence star. Stars that are less massive than the sun, that are main sequence, are smaller than the sun. Those are the red dwarfs. They're very, very common. Lots of red dwarfs out there. You say, well, our planet's tiny compared to the sun, but at least we got a pretty big star, right? Pretty big. And in fact, those little spots you see on the surface of the sun, they call those sunspots because we're not very creative, apparently. But those are cooler regions on the sun, and so they're not emitting as much light. Each one of those is about the size of the Earth, just to give you a feel for it. Say, yeah, we got a pretty big star. That's pretty awesome. That's true, but there are stars that are bigger than the sun. For example, Mintaka. Look at that. That's one of the stars of Orion's belt that you see in the winter sky. And you can see it's quite a bit bigger than the sun. But there are stars bigger than Mintaka. For example, Canopus, which you can't really see from this latitude, but if you go down south, you can see it in February, low in the south. And it's a white supergiant. Look how big it is compared to the sun. And the sun's 100 Earths across. And then there are stars bigger than Canopus, like Antares, for example. And so it just gives you a taste of God's power. Antares being about 600 suns across. Amazing. Just a sample of what God spoke into existence on day 4. Each other. Some stars gone, they're by themselves. Some stars come in binary pairs where there's two stars orbiting each other. Some stars come in clusters where you'll have maybe 100,000 stars in a relatively small area of space, 50 light years across, something like that. So this is the M80 globular star cluster. I love looking at these things. You can see these in a small telescope if you know where to look. And I love looking at globular clusters. They're just stunning. And it reminds me of that verse that says that God calls them all by their names. God has a name for each one of those stars. And we estimate there's 100,000 just in that cluster. And there are other clusters out there. So this gives you a feel for how amazing God is to keep track of all that. And of course, he keeps track not only of every star that's there and names it, but he keeps track of every atom that's in each one of those stars. All controlled by his mind. What a mind. It's pretty awesome. Some of my favorite objects are not stars at all. They're a nebula. A nebula, it means a cloud. It's Latin for cloud. And you'll see these in space. It looks like clouds in space. But they're not clouds of water vapor like you'd find in Earth's atmosphere. These are clouds of hydrogen and helium gas. That's the same stuff stars are made of. Stars are made of gas as well, held together by their own gravity. But stars are compact, and a nebula is spread out over a vast region of space. And if there are stars nearby, they'll cause that nebula to glow. And you get these wonderful, vivid colors. They're just really fun to image. And sometimes there are star clusters next to the nebula, like you have in this image. You have a star cluster in the lower right, and then the Tarantula Nebula in the upper left. Quite stunning. And enormous. Our solar system would not even show up on this image. That's how big it is. Now, there's a smaller version of a nebula, and these are called planetary nebula. And a planetary nebula is where you have one star in the middle, and it's ejecting gas, and that's forming the nebula. So it's a dynamic artwork of God, really. And so you see the star there in the middle, and it's ejecting gas, and often it ejects it kind of out the north and south pole of the star. Stars spin, so they have a north and south pole. And they have two-lobe structure. They call that a bipolar planetary nebula because of the two poles. And here's some other planetary nebula. By the way, you might think, well, it has something to do with planets. It really doesn't. It's just some of them are round and look kind of like an out-of-focus planet, but it has nothing to do with planets. But each one of these has a star in the middle, and it's ejecting gas. And so they change from decade to decade, century to century. So it's not only artwork of God, it's dynamic artwork of God. Very impressive. One of my favorites of the planetary nebulae is the Ring Nebula. And I like it because it was the first that I learned how to find. And you can see this in a small telescope. Looks like a little glowing smoke ring there in space. Looks pretty much like that, other than it's grayscale, because at night you're not using the cones which of your eyes, which are color sensitive, but rather you're using the rods, which can't see color. And so it'll look kind of like a gray version of that. It's really wonderful. In most places you point a small telescope, you'll see stars and stars and stars and stars. There's this one little magic spot not too far away from the star Vega where you will see a glowing smoke ring. It is very strange to see this little cosmic Cheerio suspended on nothing there in space. And what a delight. I still like looking at the Ring Nebula. Every time I get my telescope out, if it's the right time of year, I take a look at the Ring Nebula. Quite fun. All of these things that we've looked at, all of these stars and planets and clusters and nebulae, are part of a much larger structure called a galaxy. That's the Whirlpool Galaxy. We live in a galaxy. We think it looks kind of like that. We don't have a picture of our galaxy from above because we're in it. We can't really leave it. But we think it looks something like that. We can kind of map it out. So we live in a spiral galaxy like the Whirlpool here. So what you're seeing there is a collection of 100 billion stars. So many that it's hard to make out any individual stars. In fact, when these were first discovered, they thought maybe they were nebulae. You'll see it in some of the older textbooks, spiral nebulae. That's what they were called. But, well, they're not. They're galaxies. And it wasn't until the 1920s that we had telescopes powerful enough to see individual stars in these structures, and that confirmed that they are, in fact, other galaxies at tremendous distances. All kinds of galaxies out in the universe. They're galaxies of tremendous beauty. There are galaxies of tremendous ugliness. Yeah. There are galaxies with large mysterious arrows next to them. You'll see that in all the textbooks. There are galaxies that have rings of stars surrounding them. That's kind of interesting. There are galaxies that look like flying saucers. That's a real galaxy. The Sombrero Galaxy, they call that. You can see why. It's got that dark dust lane that surrounds the disk of the galaxy. It cuts off the light from the stars behind it. You can see this in a small telescope, part of the Virgo supercluster, visible in the spring, if you know right where to look, and it's delightful. You can see that dark dust lane cutting in front of it. Just fun to see. The space between galaxies that are in the process of collision, you might think that would be a problem, but the space between stars is enormous compared to the size of stars. If you take our entire solar system all the way out to Neptune and put it in a box, how many boxes away would the next star be? Over 4,000. And so what happens when galaxies collide? The stars are going to miss each other. The galaxies are going to harmlessly pass through each other. It's quite lovely. And I think these were made already in the process of passing through each other. It's not a problem. As you go out deeper into space, you find that galaxies come in clusters. Every one of these little specks you see here, it's not a star. It's a galaxy with hundreds of billions of stars each. And you can tell because of the fuzziness of it. That indicates it's a galaxy. As we go even deeper into space, you find galaxies upon galaxies upon galaxies upon galaxies. Pretty amazing. And that's not a star field. That's a galaxy field. You're not seeing individual stars. Each one of those little specks that you see there is a galaxy with perhaps 100 billion stars each in a tiny little section of the sky not far away from the Big Dipper. Isn't that amazing? All of this spoken into existence by God. I mean, you think of just our sun gives off more energy in 1 second than a billion cities could use in an entire year. That's one star. Our galaxy has 100 billion stars, and we think there's at least 100 billion galaxies in the universe, and that's just a sample of them right there. And those leapt into existence when God spoke. That's pretty awesome. And all this was made in 6 days, six literal days, as we saw. In fact, what you're seeing here was made in one day, day four, because that's when God created the luminaries, right? He made the sun, the moon, the stars also, and that would include galaxies. Galaxies are made of stars, so that's when they were made, is on day four of the creation week. And I love the way the Bible describes the creation of all these hundreds of billions of galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars each. It's summed up in this little phrase, he made the stars also. Interesting. God is a master of perspective. We think that, if you think about it, God spent five of the six creation days working the earth, making it right for life. He takes one day, makes everything else. That's pretty awesome. At least all the luminaries in the universe. Pretty amazing. Almost as an afterthought. Like, you know what would go really good with an earth? How about 100 billion galaxies? Why not? And again, if you think, well, why would he waste all that space? God has unlimited power. But why would he make the universe so big if it's just, you know, if really his focus is on Earth, if Earth's so important? Well, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I can tell you this. If he made it this big to impress me, he succeeded. I'm impressed. I hope you are too. You can sort of trick yourself. If you're not really familiar with the universe, if you don't know anything about it, you can sort of trick yourself into believing that it's just an accident and what have you. But the more you study the magnificence of the universe, you see it's the work of Almighty God. It's very hard to maintain that illusion that it's just an accident. So we've seen the glory of God is certainly revealed in the universe and in the realm of astronomy. The Bible's right about that. What about the basics of astronomy? And by this, I'm referring to anything that you would learn kind of in a freshman level astronomy class, just the basic stuff. The Bible's right about that too. The Bible does touch on astronomy, and when it does, it's right. Whenever the secular experts of the day have disagreed, the Bible's always turned out to be right. Yes, the Bible does touch on astronomy, and there have been some issues where at the time the verse was written, the secular experts of the day would have disagreed. They'd say the Bible's wrong, and yet today the experts would say, no, the Bible was right about that. Let me give you some examples of this. The spherical nature of the earth. The Bible describes the earth as being round in a number of places, possibly in Isaiah 40:22. It talks about the circle of the earth. You'd say, well, that could be a flat disc. And I agree the phrase is a little bit ambiguous. But I think Job 26:10, there's no other interpretation possible than that God is describing a spherical planet. Because it says that God inscribes a circle on the face of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. Now, that boundary between light and darkness is what astronomers call the terminator. That's where light stops or terminates. It's where evening or morning are happening on the earth. And the only way it can be a circle is if the world is spherical. Otherwise, it would not always be a circle, you see. And so Job 26:10 is really confirming that the world is spherical. And I mean, there are other indications too. I mean, you have a global flood. You can't have a global flood without the globe, right? A flat disk, the water's just going to run off the sides anyway. You can't cover the high hills that way. But in any case, the scripture is very clear about the world being round. Isaiah is written around 700 BC, Job's around 2000 BC. Now, interestingly, if you consult most astronomy textbooks, they will consider Pythagoras the first person to come up with the idea that the earth might be spherical. Aristotle is considered the first to prove that the world is round. And there is evidence of that where he showed that the shadow of the earth on the moon during a lunar eclipse is always round, and that would only work if the earth's spherical and so on. So we can prove that the world's round. That's pretty easy. But Aristotle is usually considered the first to prove that. And yet, Pythagoras is 500 BC, Aristotle's 300 BC, Job's 2000 BC. So before the secularists caught on to this idea, the Bible's mentioning the spherical nature of the earth. I think that's very interesting that at the time when most people thought the world was flat, the Bible's already speaking to its sphericity. Very interesting. By the way, the idea that Christopher Columbus was the first to come up with the idea that the earth might be round or that he was out to prove it, that's a myth. Edge way, which it turned out it is at the time of Columbus. He just thought it'd be faster to go that way than the other way, which it turned out it isn't because they didn't know about the Americas. So he was wrong on that account. But I'm glad he made the trip. earth hangs in space. God hangs the earth upon nothing, the Bible says in Job 26:7, a poetic way of describing the nature of gravity. God literally hangs the earth on nothing. That's a great description. It might have been hard to believe when it was written, though, because the early Greeks taught that the earth was a flat disk and floated in water, and that mimics the Babylonian belief as well, where they thought the earth was in water, floating in water. And doesn't that make more sense? Because you've seen things that float in water. You've seen boats and how they float in water. We know that. We understand buoyancy. But to hang something on nothing, that can't be done, except that's exactly how God did it. And we have pictures today that confirm that. The earth literally hangs on nothing. Again, at a time when most people did not believe that, the Bible does touch on these issues, and it gets it exactly right. The expansion of the universe. The Bible says that God stretches out the heavens as a curtain, spreads them out as a tent to dwell in, indicating that the universe is bigger now than when God initially created it. Probably, maybe not by a huge amount, but God has stretched it out to some extent. And that's mentioned a number of places in the Bible, not the least of which is Isaiah 40:22. But very clear about that. Might have been hard to believe when it was written. Frankly, if you don't know much about astronomy, you might find that hard to believe today. You go outside tonight, look at the night sky, if you get a clear night, and you look at it tomorrow night, it looks about the same size. It doesn't look like it's being stretched out or expanded. And that certainly wasn't the common belief throughout the centuries. Most astronomers believed the universe was static and unchanging. Until the 1920s, when Hubble and others came along and they showed that galaxies appear to be all moving away from each other and from us, as if the entire universe is being stretched out or expanded. How about that? And again, Isaiah, written 700 BC, but this wasn't discovered by scientific means until the late 1920s. And you need modern scientific equipment to discover this, because you can't see the movement of the galaxies. The only way you can detect it is by measuring their redshift, which means you have to have powerful telescopes and you have to have a spectrometer, and those are modern inventions. So I think it's interesting that the Hebrews somehow knew about this expansion of the universe thousands of years before it was discovered by scientific means, but how could they possibly have known that? It's almost as if they had some kind of divine insight into this issue. And of course, they did, because they're not just writing their own words. They're being moved, swept away by the Holy Spirit as they wrote. Now, some people have said, but wait a minute, if all the galaxies are moving away, does that support a Big Bang? Because if you run the movie backwards, doesn't that mean they were all in the same place at the same time? And no, not necessarily. God could have made the universe with size, and he stretched it out a bit since then. There's no reason bigger doesn't mean it exploded at one, infinitely small. Just because something's getting bigger doesn't mean it exploded into existence 13.8 billion years ago. Some of you are getting bigger, you're expanding. That doesn't mean you exploded into existence 13.8 billion years ago. It just means you're bigger than you used to be. And that happens. Nor does this count as evidence of the Big Bang. Because some people think, but wait a minute, didn't the guy who invented the Big Bang, didn't Lemaître predict that the universe should be expanding if it had exploded? And then, lo and behold, there it is. No, that gets the facts backwards. The expansion of the universe was discovered in the 1920s empirically, and then George Lemaître, who came up with the Big Bang, invented that idea in 1931. He was already aware of the expansion of the universe. That was just a naturalistic way of explaining it. So that was he already knew about the expansion. You could count it as a prediction of the Bible, though, because the Bible mentions this expansion long before it was discovered by scientific means. Conservation of energy and mass. I believe this is a biblical principle. Energy is sort of a measure of, well, energy and mass really are the same thing, according to Einstein. It's kind of the amount of stuff that you have there. And they're measured by different means, but they're the same thing. That's what E equals MC squared really means. There's a connection between those two. And conservation means it stays the same. So the amount of stuff in the universe is constant. Now, you can change types. You can convert one kind of energy into another. Convert one kind of mass into another. You've probably done chemistry, and you can change, one compound to another. But the amount of stuff that you're going to have is the same, and that's a biblical principle. We'd expect that. We'd expect no new material would pop into existence, because that would either mean that God is still creating, which cannot be, because God ended his work on the seventh day, according to Genesis 2:2, or it would mean that stuff can come into existence apart from God, which cannot be, because all things were made by him. And so I would expect nothing new would pop into existence. Furthermore, I would expect nothing would cease to exist, because God upholds all things by the word of his power, and by him or in him all things consist or hold together. So God maintains that which he created. Now, he allows it to change form, but the amount of stuff in the universe is constant, because God is finished creating and he upholds that which he created. Makes sense, doesn't it? And of course, some people, but wait a minute, can God do a creative miracle? Of course God can do a creative miracle, but those are the exceptions to the rule. The rule is that God isn't creating because he's finished his work of creation. So no new material is going to come into existence. No material is going to cease to exist. Those principles together are called conservation of energy or conservation of mass. James Joule is usually credited with the discovery of conservation of energy. He did some experiments with, colliding balls together and so on, and measuring the energy in and the energy out, and found it's always the same. And so it was very clear that we have conservation of energy. But he was a Bible believer, and when you read his works, it was very clear that he was motivated by his understanding of Scripture. He said, it makes sense that the energy in and out would be the same because God's done creating. And so you see, this is an example of how good science stems from biblical thinking. You start with the Bible, you're going to tend to draw correct conclusions about nature, which is why James Joule was able to make his discovery. Uncountable numbers of stars. The Bible describes Abraham's descendants as the stars of heaven and the sand which is upon the seashore, a figure of speech indicating a humanly uncountable number. And that's a great analogy, isn't it? You can't count the number of stars in the heaven. You can't count the number of sands on the seashore. And so that's a great figure of speech for an uncountable number. It might have seemed like just an okay expression when it was first enunciated there in Genesis, because the number of stars you can see naked eye on a clear night, if you have superb vision, is about 10,000 stars. And that's pretty big, but you could count to 10,000. It'd be tedious, but you could do it. And then in 1608, this new machine was invented, this new instrument that made distant objects look very close. They called it a spyglass at first. You probably have called it a telescope. And in 1609, Galileo built his own. In 1610, he starts taking his telescope, pointing it up. Pardon me. He begins documenting what he sees. And when Galileo pointed his telescope at the Milky Way, this cloudy band in the summer sky, he found that it's not a cloudy band, it's hundreds of billions of stars. We estimate that our own galaxy has 100 billion stars in it. You cannot count to 100 billion in your lifetime. You can't do it. Not that you'd want to, but you can't do it. It's a wonderful, wonderful indication of an uncountable number. And of course, our galaxy is just one. We think there's at least 100 billion other galaxies in the visible universe. So it was a good analogy when it was made, but we can appreciate it all the more now. And I think that's delightful. I'm very grateful for the science that confirms God's word. As I said, that there were common belief during the Middle Ages that many astronomers held to, that there were, in fact, only 1,022 stars. 1,020. Why would anyone think there are only 1,022 stars? The Greek astronomer Ptolemy had cataloged 1,022 stars. And although Ptolemy never even claimed that his list was exhaustive, there was a common philosophy that everything worth knowing had already been discovered by the Greeks. And so if Ptolemy had only cataloged 1,022 stars, there are only 1,022 stars, despite the fact you can see more than that. So it's an indication of, you see, how a bad philosophy, a bad bias can negatively affect what you see, but a biblical way of thinking can give you tremendous insight. It can help you to see things clearly. So my question is, have we learned the lesson of history? Have we learned the lesson of history? In the past, whenever the experts of the day have disagreed with the Bible has always turned out to be right. And so the takeaway is, you better trust in God's word. Have we learned that lesson today? Well, not everybody has, because there are people today that say, well, yeah, but I don't know. I think the Bible's wrong about this, that, and the other. One of those issues is the age of the universe. And the Bible does address that issue, doesn't it? But the thing that I find interesting is that although many people say, oh, the Bible got that wrong, we finally found a place where the Bible's wrong. We haven't learned a lesson in history. All the people in the past who said the Bible's wrong about the earth being spherical, the Bible's wrong about the earth hanging in space, the Bible's wrong about uncountable numbers of stars, the Bible's wrong about the expansion of the universe, they have egg on their face today. They were wrong, the Bible was right. And yet there are people today that say, well, yeah, but we're ahead of the Bible on this one. We know the universe is billions of years old. The interesting thing, though, is that there's a lot of lines of scientific evidence that confirm the biblical age of thousands of years. And yes, the Bible does teach thousands of years. It tells us that God created in 6 days. It's clear those are ordinary days. Human beings are made on day six. And from those genealogies, you can add up the ages, and you find out it's something like 6,000 years ago that God created. I can't put an exact date on it, but it's not going to be millions or billions of years. That's the point. And of course, most of the universe is made on day four. It's just 2 days older than human beings, for that matter. And there's a lot of evidence that's consistent with that. For example, the excess internal heat of the giant planets. Jupiter actually gives off twice as much energy as it receives from the sun. So it's getting one unit and gives away two. Gets one unit, spends away two. It's kind of like our federal government, right? And like the federal government, it can't do that forever because eventually you run out of energy. And now Jupiter, in 6,000 years, it hasn't expended its energy yet. It's not a problem. But if it were billions of years old, it should totally run out of energy by now. And you know this kind of thing from experience. You take a potato out of the microwave, you've just heated it up, you can feel the heat coming off. No, it's exhausted all that heat into space. You come back a couple hours later, do you still feel the heat coming off of it? No, it's exhausted all that heat into space. Jupiter is doing that. Now, Jupiter can do it a lot longer because it's a much bigger potato. It can do that for thousands of years, but it can't do it for 4.5 billion years, which is the supposed secular age for the solar system. The problem is even worse for Neptune, which you see in the lower right there. Neptune gives off over 2.6 times as much energy as it receives from the sun. And so if it were really billions of years old, why isn't it an icicle by now? Why hasn't it exhausted all of its internal heat? It's warmer. It's, by the way, both Jupiter and Neptune are cold by our standards, but they're warmer than they should be if they were billions of years old. But they're not warmer than they should be if they're a few thousand years old. They still have that internal heat. Magnetic fields. You might know the Earth has a magnetic field, an invisible shield that protects us from cosmic radiation. The Earth's magnetic field is caused by electrical current in Earth's core, and electrical current makes magnetism. And that, again, it acts like a blanket. It surrounds us, protects us from cosmic radiation. But electrical current encounters resistance, and it runs down, which means Earth's magnetic field is decaying. And we've been able to measure that decay for the last at least century and a half. And so we know it's decaying, and we can plot it backwards. Now, we think during the flood year and following the flood year, we think the magnetic field switched poles rapidly because of the tectonic motion that happened during the flood. That's kind of a side issue, but the energy has just been dropping. The energy has been dropping since creation, and we figure the magnetic field was about 20 times stronger at creation. It'd be kind of nice. You'd have increased protection from cosmic rays. You'd have fewer mutations, fewer disease. That would be kind of nice. And but you do the math, you run it backwards, and because it's an exponential decay, that means in the past it was much, much stronger. You go back 60,000 years following the same trend. You go back 60,000 years, and the Earth's magnetic field would be stronger than that of a neutron star, which is enough to rip the atoms of your body apart, rip the iron right out of your blood. You don't want that. So my point is, if the Earth were even 60,000 years old, there's no way you could have life on it. And supposedly it's 4.5 billion years old. That's a problem in the secular view. It's not a problem for biblical creation because 20 times stronger, that wouldn't pose a problem. That's what we think it was at creation. And it's not just the Earth. Some of the other planets of the solar system have strong magnetic fields as well. Jupiter has a magnetic field. It'd be bigger than the sun if you could see it. It's enormous, very, very powerful. Why does Jupiter still have that magnetic field if it's been decaying for 4.5 billion years? It should be gone by now. But it's not. It's still there, and it's very strong. The planets Uranus and Neptune. Here's the planet Uranus. Uranus is tilted on its side, so it rotates this way. And the magnetic field is not even aligned with the rotation axis enough that you can actually have through the side of the planet there. And it's strong enough that you can actually have aurora borealis, northern lights, on Uranus. And that's what you're seeing there. And the bottom of that image, that bright spot, is northern lights. And Uranus is much further away from the sun. And so these particles that travel from the sun and they get disturbed by the magnetic field, that's what causes northern lights. It's the interaction with the sun's the sun's particles and the magnetic field. So it has a substantial magnetic field. So does Neptune. A colleague of mine, Dr. Russ Humphreys, who is a creationist like myself and a physicist, actually predicted the magnetic field of both Uranus and Neptune before they were measured by the Voyager 2 spacecraft. And he did that back in 1984. You can read his publication. He says, based on the age of 6,000 years, the magnetic field of Uranus should have decayed to this amount. This is what I predict. And Voyager 2 went past, and it measured that prediction. The secularists were way off. They thought the magnetic fields of those planets would be dead by now because they're allegedly billions of years old. But Humphreys was right on. Isn't that interesting? And if you're wondering how secularists deal with this, well, they say there must be some kind of recharging mechanism, which they call a dynamo. The idea is it recharges that magnetic field over time. But one of the predictions of the dynamo is that the magnetic field axis should be aligned with the rotation axis. And you can see that's not even remotely the case, nor with Neptune, by the way. The recession of the moon. Did you know the moon is actually moving away from the Earth due to tidal forces? So the moon, of course, orbits the Earth, but the moon induces tidal bulges on the Earth's oceans. And so as the moon's pulling on the Earth and it's pulling a tidal bulge up, but the Earth rotates quicker than the moon orbits. And so the tidal bulge gets ahead of the moon and that pulls forward on it. And when you pull forward on something in orbit, it moves out. A little bit counterintuitive, but if you've ever played with a gyroscope, you know that when things are spinning, they don't always behave kind of like you'd expect. So the moon is moving outward. And today the rate is about 1.5 inches a year. It's not a huge rate, but we can measure that. We can measure that distance to the moon very precisely. And if you run the equation backwards, if you think about it, the moon in the past would have been closer to the Earth, which means the tidal bulge would have been larger, and so it would have moved even faster and larger and faster. And it turns out, you do the math right, the moon dives into the Earth at 1.4 to 1.5 billion years in a hypothetical past. You say, well, that sounds like a long time, but here's the problem. In the secular view, the Earth and moon are supposed to be 4.5 billion years old. But you see, they can't be older than 1.4 billion years because they'd be in the same place at the same time. And that's a problem, you see. And so the maximum theoretical age of 1.4 billion years is less than the secular age of 4. You're with me, right? Because 1.4 is less than 4.5. Yes? You're with me? Okay. Even the Common Core folks are getting that? Okay. Very good. Comets are made up of ice and dirt, and they orbit around the sun in elliptical paths. The ice remains frozen when it's far away. Then it comes close to the sun and gets whiplashed back out. Now think about that. Ice close to the sun. That can't be good, right? And you're correct. When that icy material gets close to the sun, the sun vaporizes it, and that's what forms a comet's tail. So that stream that you see there, that's material being blasted away from the nucleus of the comet. Every time you see a comet, it's getting smaller. And we can measure the rate at which the material is being depleted. We can measure the size of the comet. And we estimate that a typical comet can last no more than about 100,000 years maximum before it totally runs out of material. So why do we still have comets if the solar system's 4.5 billion years old? Interesting. And my secular colleagues would say, well, there must be some kind of comet generator out there that makes new comets, which they call the Oort cloud. Oh, and you'll see it in all the textbooks, but that's the only place you'll see it. You won't see it in your telescopes. It's hypothetical. It's purely hypothetical. And I don't think there's any evidence for it. Comets just would seem to be an indication that the solar system is young. It's not billions of years old. Spiral galaxies. We live in a spiral galaxy. Not all galaxies are spiral, but a lot of them are. We live in a spiral galaxy. And they have those beautiful, stunning spiral arms that rotate. And the interesting thing is they rotate differentially, which means the inner portions rotate fast, the outer portions rotate slower. And if you think about that, that means that spiral structure would have to be getting twisted tighter and tighter, wouldn't it? If the inner portions are rotating faster than the outer portions. It's called differential rotation. And so I actually ran a simulation, a computer simulation, to see how long would it take for a spiral galaxy to be twisted beyond recognition. And by about 100 million years of a hypothetical rotation, it's like an old-fashioned phonograph record. It's the spiral arms are so tight you can't distinguish them, really. It becomes a uniform disk. Now, that's interesting because we find all kinds of spiral galaxies. The secularists believe these galaxies are 10 billion years old. But you see, if they were more than 100 million years old, they would be twisted beyond recognition. You would not see spiral structure. And we don't see galaxies that are twisted beyond recognition. We see perfectly designed spiral galaxies as if they've been rotating just a little bit. It's consistent with a few thousand years of rotation. Of course, I think God made them spirals to begin with, and they've rotated just a bit since creation. You might notice also the spiral arms have a bluish tinge to them, and that's legitimate. That's because the arms of a spiral galaxy have a higher proportion of blue stars. And blue stars are themselves an indication of the youth of the universe because blue stars cannot last billions of years. Off an incredible amount of stars are the most massive, most luminous stars in the galaxy. They give off an incredible amount of energy. Now, it happens they're the most massive. They have the most fuel available, but they burn it at an incredible rate. They're kind of like the SUV of the star world. They have a big gas tank, but they get very poor gas mileage, and so they can't go very far in time. And my secular colleagues won't even dispute that. They know that the hottest, bluest stars can't last more than like a million years. And yet, we find them all over this universe that's allegedly 13.8 billion years old. Problem. And so my secular colleagues would say, well, again, they must be forming. Blue stars must form, but the star formation is really problematic, because how do you get a nebula that's spread out over a vast region of space and collapse it down into a star? You say, well, gravity. Well, the force of gravity in these nebulae is very meager, and it's normally outweighed by gas pressure. Gas pressure tends to make a nebula expand. And so I think it's very problematic to assume that these stars have formed by themselves. You'll see the textbooks. Oh, here's a star-forming region. What they're not seeing stars form. Nobody's seen a star form. What they're seeing are blue stars, and they're saying they must have formed recently, so it's a star-forming region. That's the logic of it. But really, it's just an indication of a young universe. And there are lots more, too. But I think we've seen that the evidence really is consistent with the biblical timescale of thousands of years, not just in our solar system, but in the universe beyond as well. Well, aside from the age issue, there's another issue where my secular colleagues would disagree with a straightforward reading of Scripture, and that concerns the uniqueness of the earth. In the Bible, the earth is very special. It's a planet that God formed to be inhabited, where he put the life forms that he created. Isaiah 45:18, he is the God who formed the earth and made it. He established it and did not create it a waste place, but formed it to be inhabited. The earth is designed for life. The other objects out in space, not designed for life, except in so much as they make life on earth possible. And that is evidenced when we take a look at some of these other objects. Earth really is special. Again, Earth's made, according to the Scripture, Earth's made on day one. All the other luminaries out there are made on day four. And that would include the other planets, by the way. The Hebrew word for star, kokab, would include planets as well. We use a slightly different classification today. But so all these other objects are made on day four, almost as an afterthought, to provide Earth with a mechanism for signs, seasons, days, and years, and to declare God's glory. But they're not formed to be inhabited. And that the evidence bears that out. When we look at the moon, it's beautiful. There is a beauty to the moon, but it's a desolate beauty because you don't find that life that you find on the earth. One of the astronauts who walked on the moon's surface referred to it as a magnificent desolation. I think it's a wonderful description of the beauty of the moon, but it's not designed for life. Even the astronauts, in order to survive on the moon, they had to take a little bit of earth with them. They had to take some air from the earth. The moon were not designed for it. They had to take some food from the earth. Spacesuits to protect them from the harsh vacuum of the moon were not designed for that. Life is not designed for the moon. The moon's not designed for life. It's designed for what it does. It's to be for signs, seasons, days, and years. The planets that are closest to the earth, you got Venus on the left, you got Mars on the right. Venus is often called Earth's sister planet because it's about the same size. But that's where the similarity ends, because the surface temperature of Venus is over 900 degrees Fahrenheit. So, although there's no humidity, so it's a dry heat, for whatever it's worth. It's permanently enshrouded by clouds, and that left the secularists free to speculate that there might be all kinds of exotic life on the surface, but that was before they learned the surface temperature was 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Those clouds we now know are made of sulfuric acid-type compounds. Really nasty. Venus is not a place you want to go on your next vacation. And, you know, some people say, well, wait a minute, why would God make a planet like that with a toxic atmosphere and a surface temperature 900 degrees Fahrenheit and so on? Well, you're not supposed to go there. He didn't make it as a vacation spot. He made it to be beautiful, right? Venus, those clouds make Venus the third brightest object in our sky. You got sun, moon, Venus, and it is beautiful. You've maybe seen it in the evening sky or in the morning sky. Stunningly beautiful. You got Mars a little bit further away from the sun. Mars is a little too cold for life. Don't have liquid water on its surface, as far as we know, at least not in any abundance. The atmosphere is 100 times thinner than the Earth's. You couldn't breathe on Mars. That'd be a problem. And what atmosphere there is carbon dioxide, which you can't breathe anyway. So it doesn't have that protective magnetic field that the Earth has. Mars is not designed for life. It's bitter cold. It's kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. You got two planets too hot, you got a planet too cold. Earth's just right because it's at the right distance from the sun to receive the proper amounts of heat and light. And that brings up the question, what about aliens then? What about aliens? And I admit that the Bible doesn't say one way or the other that there are aliens or that there are not aliens beyond Earth. But given all the emphasis the Bible makes on God making life on Earth and the fact that Earth is formed to be inhabited and so on, I would not expect to find life out in space. And if you have intelligent life, Vulcans and Klingons have logical problems you're going to have to really think through, because if there are Vulcans and Klingons out there, you realize they can't be saved because they're not related by blood to Jesus. It's because we're related to Jesus that his blood counts for us on the cross. He's our kinsman redeemer. But Lieutenant Worf is out of luck because he's a Klingon and he's not related to Jesus. He can't be saved. And then people think, well, maybe Jesus went to the Klingon homeworld and became a Klingon to die for them. No, the Bible says he died once for all. He's raised incorruptible. He's never going to die again. And what if the Klingons never sinned? Well, then they're suffering the effects of the curse of Adam's sin. It doesn't make any sense, does it, to have intelligent life out in space? And frankly, it's the secularists that get puzzled over this. We call it the Fermi paradox, after Enrico Fermi, who was a scientist, apparently a secular scientist, who was thinking, where are they? He thought, if life evolved on Earth, it probably evolved in space. And in some places, it would have evolved before Earth, because it's a big universe after all. And so there should be at least a few planets out there that should have become spacefaring civilizations. They should have colonized the galaxy by now. But the galaxy is not colonized. Where are they? And I want to suggest to you that the lack of aliens out there is actually an indication that the biblical worldview is right from the beginning and the secular worldview is wrong. At least it's consistent with that. What about distant starlight then? So we've talked about the fact that the universe is about 6,000 years old based on the information given in the Bible, in the history book of the universe. And yet people say, oh, but that can't be because there are these galaxies that are so far away, and there are galaxies that are very far away, that given that distance, as fast as light is, galaxies are so far away that the most distant ones, it ought to take billions of years for the light to get from there to here. And yet we see the galaxies, so obviously the light has gone from there to here. So doesn't that mean the universe is at least billions of years old? The Bible's wrong, therefore? Well, again, if you're thinking that way, you haven't learned anything from history, because there have always been times where people have had objections. Well, the Earth can't really be round, and the Earth can't really hang on nothing. That's impossible. And yet the Bible has always been vindicated. But I want to give you what I think is the answer to this issue. Not that we're required to have one. There are some things in the Bible that we're not going to have a mechanism to explain them. I don't think that you're ever going to convince me of the mechanism by which Jesus raised himself from the dead. I don't know what the scientific mechanism is there, or if there is even one. It's God can do what he wants, and that's the point. Nonetheless, I think we do have an answer to this. But I do have to point out, before I get to it, that a lot of the solutions that people propose are really not good solutions. And I just mentioned this very briefly, otherwise people will come up, but have you thought of this? Yes, we've thought of that. There's a reason it doesn't work. For example, some people have said, well, maybe the distances aren't real. Maybe those galaxies are actually very close to us. That's just scientific. The methods by which we measure the distances to these galaxies, I'm not going to get into that. They're good scientific measurements. They're not based on evolutionary thinking or anything like that. Some people have proposed that maybe the speed of light was much faster in the past. And that was a good assumption to test, because a lot of times evolutionists assume that a rate is constant when really it isn't. And you do the math reworking the non-constant rate, and you find that, oh, it lines up with biblical creation. But I think in this case, there's good evidence that the speed of light has always been what it is today. The speed of light is not like other speeds. It's a foundational property of the universe that sets the relationship between mass and energy, the relationship between electric fields and magnetic fields, and so on. You change the speed of light too much, and atoms would not even be possible. So we think the speed of light has been always what it is today in terms of the round-trip speed of light. Some people have said, well, the light was made in transit. God not only made the stars on day four, but he made a beam of light connecting the star to the Earth with images of that star in it all the way along the beam. And no doubt God has the power to do that. But I don't think that's the right answer either, because light in transit, that idea requires God to create fictional images and movies of things that never happen. And I'll give you an example of this. Here we have supernova 1987A. On the left frame, the arrow is pointing to a blue star there that in 1987 blew itself to bits, and the explosion we see there on the right. And stars are big, so it takes months for them to explode. And then today it looks like that. And you're seeing what's left of that star expanding out into space, star guts expanding out into space, basically. Now this is 160,000 light years away, which means in secular thinking that event really happened 160,000 years ago, and the light from it took all that time and finally reached the Earth in the year 1987. Now, if your solution to that is to say, well, I think God made the beam of light already on its way, then that means that that star that you see in that left frame never existed. It was just a picture that God put in a light beam about 6,000, and that explosion likewise never happened. It's a picture, a sequence of pictures that God put in a beam of light about 6,000 light years out that finally reached the earth in 1987. And again, it's not that God lacks the power to do that. God can do what he wants, but my point is God wouldn't want to do that because God's not the author of confusion. These would require that none of these things ever existed. God made our senses, and he made them to be basically reliable, so he's not going to deceive us that way. He'd say, I don't know, I think God might make images of fictional things. Well, careful, because you've now lost any basis for knowing anything, because how do you know I'm here right now? He said, well, we see you. No, I said, well, no, actually, you're seeing light that God made 1 inch away from your eye, a picture of me. Well, we hear you too. No problem, God made the sound 1 inch away from your ear. But you're just a brain in a jar, for all we know, right? And that's not the Christian worldview. God gave us reliable senses. So I think these events really happened, and they happened within the biblical timescale. When do I think it works? Heaven happened in 1987, and I'll show you how that works. Basically, here's what I think the answer is. Not everyone agrees with me, but there are other creation physicists who do agree with me. The solution may involve the one-way speed of light. The one-way speed of light, what does that mean? Well, the speed of light, which is abbreviated with the lowercase letter c, is 186,282 miles per second, so it's very fast. But that is a round-trip time-averaged speed. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean that in most experiments where you measure the speed of light, they basically boil down to a scenario kind of like this. Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to stand over here with my flashlight. We're going to build a long hallway. We'll build it 186,000 miles long. We'll pretend we have government funding. We can waste it that way. And at the other end, we'll put a mirror. Okay? And what I'm going to do is when my watch strikes noon, I'm going to turn on my flashlight for just an instant. The light beam is going to travel down that long hallway. That's an incredible distance. That's a distance. That's a fraction of the way to the moon. Bounce off the mirror, come back. And then when I see the reflection, I'll look at my watch again and see how long it took. And if I did that, I would find that they would take 2 seconds to see my reflection. Which in that itself is kind of amazing because you look in a mirror and you think, well, that's instantaneous. Technically, your image is a little bit behind where you are, just a little bit, because it takes a little bit of time for the light to go back and reflect. And if the hallway were that long, that's how long it would take, 2 seconds. Now, it's had to travel a distance of 186,000 miles twice that distance, and it takes 2 seconds, so you divide and you get an average speed of 186,000 miles per second. So that's why we did it that way, so the math would be easy. Now, most of you have probably assumed that it took the light 1 second to go out, hit the mirror, and then 1 second for it to come back. And I've depicted it that way, so you could be forgiven for assuming that. But I don't really know that, do I? Because I'm not where the mirror is, I'm where the flashlight is. All I know for sure is when I turned on the flashlight right at noon, and I know when I see the reflection right at 12:00:02. That's all I know for sure. It could be, hypothetically, that the light took no time to zip out and hit that mirror, and took all of the 2 seconds to come back. I'd see the same thing, wouldn't I? I'd see the reflection 2 seconds later. Or it could be that the light takes all of 2 seconds to go out and no time at all to come back. That could be the case as well. And you see my point? Either way, regardless of which scenario happens, all I know is the reflection happens 2 seconds later. That's all I know for sure. Now, some people would say, oh, but why would the speed of light be different directions? Now, I don't know, but I don't know why it would have to be the same either. You can't just assume things are the same because wouldn't that be nice, right? That's a logical fallacy. It's appeal to consequences. But no, it could be the case that the speed of light, hypothetically, the universe is weird. An observer is instantaneous. You say, that's weird. Well, I got news for you. The universe is weird. There's a lot of things in quantum mechanics that are just amazing, and I'd have a hard time convincing you that they're true, but they're true. Maybe the speed of light's like that. Now, of course, it could be the same in all directions. That's another possibility. But the point is, we don't know. Now, if the bottom scenario is the correct one, if the speed of light when it's moving toward me is instantaneous, then you realize there's no distant starlight problem. So I'm kind of rooting for that to be the answer, but again, wishing for something doesn't make it so. How might we test to see if the speed of light's different in different directions? And by the way, I'm not suggesting that the mirror has anything to do with it. You could have your buddy down there with another flashlight, and when he sees the thing, he sends out a new pulse. It doesn't matter whether it's reflected or emitted. I'm suggesting that perhaps the speed of light just is different directions depending on where the observer is. But how do we test that? How do I test the idea that maybe the speed of light is different that way than it is that way? Well, we'd have to measure the speed of light on a one-way trip. Can't use a mirror anymore, right? But now I'm going to need another clock. I'm going to tell me one. I have to have one clock here to tell me when to start the experiment, right at noon, and then I have to have another clock over there that tells me when the light arrives and records the time. And so, how long do you think this experiment will take? Well, I did this in my office. I don't have the long hallway, but I have the distance between my watch and the clock on my phone. Okay, and that's a shorter distance, but I can do the math. I can divide it out. And so I did this experiment, right? My watch struck noon, I turned on the flashlight, the light went, hit the phone, and I read the time as soon as it was illuminated. So that tells me what time it hit the phone. And the clock said 12:05. And so apparently it took 5 minutes. Boy, it didn't seem like it. It seemed like it was instantaneous. But apparently it took 5 minutes, right, for the light to go from my watch to the phone. You're not buying that? It really is true that my watch said 12. I turned on the flashlight, it hit the phone said 12:05. That really happened, but that's obviously because the clock on my phone is 5 minutes fast, right? You understand that. It would be ridiculous for me to conclude that it really took 5 minutes to get there. So my point is, this experiment only works if these clocks are synchronized. And you know about synchronized, right? It means both clocks read the same time at the same time. We know that from those old spy movies, right? So, okay, let's all synchronize our watches. So these clocks have to be synchronized. And by the way, they have to be exactly synchronized. Approximately is not good enough. Because if the clock on that end of the hallway is 1 second off of this clock, it'll be the difference between the speed of light being a half C and infinity. It makes a huge difference, okay? Because we're measuring something that's fast. There's no doubt about that. So the clocks have to be exactly synchronized. You say, no problem. We'll make sure the clocks are exactly synchronized as by radio transmission. Turns out that's hard to do. Normally the way clocks are synchronized is by radio transmission. There is a radio station in Fort Collins, Colorado, connected to the atomic clock in Boulder, and it's constantly sending out a radio pulse that tells the time. And some people have clocks. Maybe you have a clock that synchronizes itself. I have one in my apartment that synchronizes itself to that atomic clock. I never have to set it. It's pretty neat because it receives that radio broadcast, and right? Radio synchronization, no problem. Fort Collins sends out the radio pulse. My clock receives it, sets itself to noon. But wait a minute. Radio's fast, but maybe not infinitely fast. Maybe that radio pulse takes a little bit of time to get from Fort Collins to travel down to where I'm at, down in the Colorado Springs. Okay, it takes a little bit of time to travel. So technically, my clock is a little bit behind the atomic clock. Well, it's a fraction of a second. But remember, that's not good enough. These clocks have to be exactly synchronized if we're going to measure the speed of light in one direction. Yes? Well, if I knew how long it took the radio pulse to get there, I could compensate for that. If I knew the radio took 1 second to get there, I could push my clock 1 second forward, right? So if I knew the speed at which radio travels, then I could synchronize my clocks. Do you know the speed at which radio travels? Anybody? Speed of light. Yep. But that's the very thing I'm trying to measure, you see. So in order to synchronize, I'm trying to measure the one-way speed of light. To do that, I have to have two clocks exactly synchronized. But to synchronize them, I'd have to already know the one-way speed of light. You see the problem? It's a catch-22. Now, some people have thought that if you put the radio transmitter in between the two, that'll fix it, but it won't, because that assumes that the speed of radio and therefore the speed of light is the same in all directions. And that's the very question we're trying to answer. Some people have thought if you synchronize both clocks at the same place, and that's easy because you can see they both read noon, and then you move them, then they'll be synchronized, right? Wrong, because according to Einstein, motion affects the passage of time. Now, it's a small effect. But the fact is, the very act of moving these clocks causes them to potentially become desynchronized. Motion affects time. Now, fortunately, there is an equation that tells you how much motion affects time. Einstein discovered that as well. And so we could put that into the formula and find out how much it's affected. But guess what? In that formula is the speed of light, the very thing I'm trying to measure. Okay. Weird. Do you get the point? Here's the point. It's a catch-22. Apparently, it's impossible to synchronize two clocks separated by a distance without already knowing the one-way speed of light. And it's impossible to measure the one-way speed of light without two clocks that are synchronized by a distance. Interesting. It's a permanent catch-22. And just apologetics issues aside, I just think that's fascinating that God has constructed the universe in such a way it is impossible to measure, in any case, the first assuming it. Isn't that interesting? And in any case, the conclusion that I'm going to offer is that the one-way speed of light is not a property of nature at all, but it's a convention. A convention is something we choose, and we all agree to it, and it works, like the metric system. That's a convention. Or the English system. You want to use feet? You want to use meters? Fine. Just as long as you stick with it, you're good. And a man named John Winnie back in the 1970s demonstrated that Einstein's relativity does not depend on the one-way speed of light. You can pick the one-way speed of light to be whatever you want in one direction. Now, the round-trip speed has to be C. That's set by God. Can't change that. The one-way speed, you can set it to be whatever you like between a half C and infinity, and that will tell you how to synchronize clocks. And then when you measure the one-way speed of light using those synchronized clocks, it'll be whatever you chose it to be. As long as you do the math correctly, you can use any system at all. So my point is, the one-way speed of light's not something you're ever going to discover, because it's something that we decide, and that tells us what constitutes synchronized clocks, you see. And that was something that Einstein knew about. I'm not going to go into details on that for time's sake. But here's my point. We can use a system called an anisotropic, which means different directions, synchrony convention. Anisotropic synchrony convention, or ASC. And under that convention, light, when it's moving toward an observer, toward you, is instantaneous. It takes no time at all. No matter how far away those galaxies are, it takes no time for their light to get to you. But to send a signal back would take a long time, because it's moving away from you then, because of the way we've chosen to synchronize clocks. That's a legitimate way of synchronizing clocks. There's nothing weird about light. It's just it's the nature of the universe. It's the nature of space and time that you can do that. And if the Bible uses that this anisotropic synchrony convention, then there is no distant starlight problem. And I know this gets a little bit in depth. I know, but the point is that under this convention, which is based on known physics, light takes no time at all if you use this convention to get from anywhere in the universe to here. Now, to go out, it would take time, but we don't need it to go out. We just need it to get here. That's all we need. And so the distant starlight, all ancient cultures did. Bible uses ASC, and I think the Bible does use ASC, because for two reasons. First of all ancient cultures did. All ancient cultures, when they marked time by when they saw something happening, and that's a very natural thing to do. Very natural. You look across the hill and you see a deer. That's pretty. You don't say, well, I wonder how many billions of years ago that really happened. That's very unnatural. It makes sense. So if I see it, it's happening now. And so that was the way all ancient cultures did it. But I think it's also suggested in scriptures explicitly in passages like Genesis 1:14 and 15. Then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. Let them be for signs, seasons, days, and years. And we find out later that's the sun, moon, the stars also, the greater light, the lesser light, the stars also, right? So that's the stars, among other things. And it says, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. What was so? He made the lights, and they gave light on the earth. Interesting, yeah. So apparently, the stars needed no time at all to give their light on the earth. As soon as God spoke them into existence, they immediately fulfilled their God-ordained role to give light on the earth. How about that? And that makes sense in light of this anisotropic synchrony convention that I've mentioned. And we have several physicists that have corroborated that as well. Again, we got plenty of books out there. Ultimate Proof of Creation, giving you a bulletproof argument for biblical creation. DVDs as well. Again, the DVDs didn't make it, but you can still purchase them, and we'll ship them to you. Discerning Truth, How to Spot Logical Fallacies and Arguments that Evolutionists Tend to Make. Keeping Faith in an Age of Reason, Answering Over 400 Alleged Bible Contradictions. I thought I'd blank those out, but I guess I didn't. Don't forget that we have the book Pack as well, and that's a great resource where you can get all of those together. And then, of course, Stargazer's Guide to the Night Sky and Taking Back Astronomy. Let me hit those specifically, and I'm sorry I did the slides a little bit wrong there, but I think I have them on this one anyway. Yeah, the book that covers what I covered today is this one, Taking Back Astronomy. It covers everything other than the starlight issue, because that's kind of its own little monster. And The Physics of Einstein deals with the starlight issue in greater depth. So Taking Back Astronomy, it's a wonderful resource. It's got lots of beautiful full-color pictures. Some people have thought it's a children's book because of the pictures. It really isn't. It's just my theory is adults like pictures too. And it's one of the way the universe declares God's glory is its beauty. And then, of course, Stargazer's Guide to the Night Sky, How to Better Enjoy the Night Sky from a Christian Perspective. If you want to know where to locate these things that I've talked about, this book will show you how to do that, where they're at. Created Cosmos takes you on a tour of the universe from a biblical perspective. That's the planetarium show I wrote for the Creation Museum years ago. And then a lot of other resources as well. Don't forget to sign up for a free monthly newsletter. And I don't mention this a lot, but we could use financial support. We're a donation to Sonner staff, and we really could use a little more finances. I'd love to be able to bring on a few more scientists on our staff. If you go to our website, there's a place you can partner with us. We have monthly partners. That would be very helpful to us. But the website itself is a free resource for you, and I encourage you to check that out, biblicalscienceinstitute.com. And we'll be back in 10 minutes, I believe, to hear more from Dr. Gentry on the worldview significance of creation. So thank you very much.